The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. You know, when the target is moving and the information is dubious, it's hard to respond credibly to events. That is the situation we may find ourselves in the Middle East today. A crisis regarding the quality of intelligence guiding White House policy at the very same moment as Turkey and Russia are getting into it near the Syrian border. It's hardly the first time the CIA, you'll recall, called evidence of Saddam Hussein's nuclear program a slam dunk. Not quite. Earlier, the Vietnam War was prolonged by what were eventually found to be overly optimistic counts of enemy killed on the battlefield and a misplaced faith in air power. Well, we will look at the problems with U.S. intelligence regarding ISIS just a little later this hour. Also, the tragic idea that a sorry chapter in American history might be repeating itself. The niece of a real American hero gets a medal at the White House for her uncle. Lots more to explain about that. But first, the latest downing of a Russian plane shot down by Turkey, called by Russia's Vladimir Putin a stab in the back. Does this represent an escalation in the conflict? Does it raise more doubts about Russia, the U.S., France, Britain, and Turkey working together in this crowded region? Soner Chayaptay is the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He joins me from Ankara, Turkey. Soner, what's the situation right now as far as the Turkish media is reporting this?
Well, unrelated, I happen to be in Ankara for my own meetings and work today, and this is a very tense situation between Turkey and Russia. The two countries are historic enemies. The Ottoman Turks and the Russians fought 17 wars between the 19th century and the end of the Russian Empire with the Bolshevik Revolution. And all these wars were started by the Russians, and guess who lost all of them? The Ottoman Turks. So Turkey is in no position to pick a fight with the Russians, but they also want to tell the Russians, stay out of our airspace. And I think today's event of the Turkey shooting down a Russian plane was a clear signal to the Russians that Turkey doesn't want to pick a fight, but it also should not be forced to defend its own territory.
What's become of the pilots, as far as we know?
It looks like they're on the ground. They might even be in the hands of FSA, that's Free Syrian Army rebels. So this is definitely a serious escalation. And it also comes on the day that, just as I'm in Ankara, the vice chair of Joint Chief of Staff, General Selva, is in Ankara. So this is obviously an interesting timing. Turkey is also showing to Russia that its old ally, United States, is back. And there is some more domestic context to what happened today. Russia, for a while, had been bombing areas in northern Syria that are populated by Turkmens, in which the anti-regime forces are active. And Turkish media was just really up in arms against the suffering of the Turkmens, who are ethnically related to the Turks, in the hands of the Russians. So it looks like the government is killing a few birds with one stone, not only giving Russia a signal to stay out of Turkish airspace, but also telling the Turkish public that it is doing something at least to protect the Turkmens and to prevent their suffering in the hands of Russian planes.
Is there any clarity as to whether the Russian plane actually did enter Turkish airspace, or is that...
It looks that it did. I have seen some social media reporting and also talked to some friends in government here, which suggests that the Russians did violate Turkish airspace. In fact, Russian planes had been violating Turkish airspace ever since Russia deployed troops and planes into northern Syria. And part of it is driven by necessity. Not that the Russians always want to violate airspace, but the way the rebel positions are so close to the Turkish border, and these planes sometimes have to make big loops when they maneuver, so they are forced to violate Turkish airspace. But Turkey's basically saying this is the end of Turkish tolerance and patience with the symbolic act today. We hope that it does not escalate because nobody's interested in a full-scale war. But I've also seen reports that Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov just canceled his visit to Ankara, which was supposed to take place tomorrow, to discuss Syria. So this is a serious escalation in Turkish-Russian ties, probably the most serious escalation since the end of the Cold War, when obviously Turkey was with the United States against communist Russia. And we haven't seen anything like this in 20 years or more, I would say.
What do you make of the NATO emergency meeting in Brussels today? What do you think can come out of that? Will it be solidarity for Turkey, or will it be an attempt to reassure Russia that we're not picking a fight?
Absolutely solidarity. I think NATO is a rock-hard, solid alliance when it comes to standing against Russia. And I think, especially because Turkey is an alliance member, it's no less than, let's say, NATO defending Estonia or Poland. I think NATO will come in a strong statement in favor of the Turkish position. especially because it seems that Turkey was exercising its right to self-defense when the Russian plane had crossed into Turkish airspace as it was shut down. So I think that we can expect a solid NATO statement in favor of Turkey.
Is NATO's position on the Kurds the same position as Turkey's approach to the Kurds? The United States, of course, is very much in bed with the Kurds in Iraq, trying to support the territory of the Kurds and to roll back ISIS.
Well, in Syria, it is, meaning in Syria, United States is working with Kurdish groups to push back against ISIS, but not in Iraq, where there is a Turkish-Kurdish group called the PKK, and this group is recognized as a terrorist entity, not only by Turkey and the United States, but also by NATO, and that's not going to change anytime soon. So I think U.S. policy and NATO policy on the Kurds is rather nuanced, and even in Syria, I think there are limitations to this policy. The Kurds there, in their groups known as the Party for Democratic Unity, PYD, and its armed wing, YPG, have helped liberate some territory from ISIS, and that was welcome news. But at the same time, many folks that I speak with at the Department of Defense and other U.S. government agencies are very aware of the fact that the reach of the Kurds in Syria is limited, meaning they can only take from ISIS areas that are Kurdish, but one should not realistically expect them to take over from ISIS areas that are not Kurdish. And I think we have seen the end of Kurdish push against ISIS now that the Kurds have taken much of the areas that are ethnically Kurdish, but they have come to the end of their physical expansion. At this stage, I think the United States needs Sunni Arab allies for a significant push against ISIS in Syria.
Soner Çayapte is director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, speaking to us from Ankara. Soner, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
President Obama is being pushed in various directions on what to do in Syria, but can he trust the intelligence he's getting?
I don't want intelligence shaded by politics. I don't want it shaded by the desire to tell a feel-good story. We can't make good policy unless we've got good, accurate, hard-headed, clear-eyed intelligence.
So does the president have that? He's investigating reports that he, in fact, isn't getting that quality intelligence. And that was the president speaking to reporters from Malaysia on Sunday. The New York Times has been reporting on dubious intelligence regarding ISIS for a while, but this is the first time the president has publicly acknowledged reports of shaded intelligence estimates of ISIS. Michael Prejant is a former U.S. Army intelligence officer in Iraq who served as intelligence advisor to General David Petraeus, now an adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute. Michael, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Michael, let's start straight ahead. What are the pressures on the intelligence operatives in Iraq to give the president overly optimistic reports on what ISIS is? Do we even know what ISIS is?
Well, they would have the best intelligence, and they should be listened to. One of the problems you have is senior leadership, and it's not only unique to CENTCOM, but also the Defense Intelligence Agency and also the CIA. Senior leadership sometimes curry favor with the White House so they can get positions in the next White House, and that's one of the problems you have, I think, with this situation. In 2009, we couldn't get a slide in front of the National Security Council on Iraq or Afghanistan. We were frustrated and we were told, hey, listen, they just don't want to see it. They don't want to hear anything more about Iraq. They don't want to hear anything more about Afghanistan unless it's good news stories. And that's the biggest problem here. Anytime the intelligence community is faulted for not knowing something about the Arab Spring or ISIS or security degradation across the globe, there are always analysts in these agencies that are warning about these issues, but it just doesn't pass their first-line supervisors, and it certainly doesn't get in front of decision-makers when you have politicized intelligence supervisors.
Now, ISIS is a fundamentally different kind of entity here. How do you measure success or failure in rolling it back on the battlefield? Even if you roll back territory, you don't necessarily prevent what happened in Paris, right?
Yeah, there's a bit of a schism going on within ISIS right now. You have the pragmatic Baathists that joined the Islamic State in order to have a Sunni return to power in Iraq and Syria. They're not too happy about making too many enemies. They're not necessarily happy about ISIS shooting down a Russian airliner in the Sinai, and certainly not happy about mass casualty producing attack in Paris. when you bring on too many enemies, you lose the ability to hold ground. So there's a schism between the apocalyptic component of ISIS and the Baathists. And I believe if the intelligence community is looking at ISIS now, they're likely to see a lot of former Baathists that joined the movement moving back to Iraq, where it's a more permissive environment ahead of Russian and French airstrikes on Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor.
So do they want to hold territory, or do they want to declare war on the entire world, which is what ideology?
They have to hold territory. That's what makes ISIS different, is holding on to territory. These al-Qaeda-like attacks, anyone can do them. Boko Haram just did one. Al-Qaeda can do them. Anyone can do them. Holding on to territory is something unique to ISIS. It's hard to hold down to territory when you cannot shoot down aircraft. ISIS does not have the ability to shoot down aircraft. ISIS 2.0 may have that ability, but this current terrorist army does not.
What is the CENTCOM or the, U.S. deployment right now in Iraq to push back ISIS? There are troops working with Iraqi soldiers down in Iraq, and then, of course, there's the air cover. Is that it?
It's minimal. The Iraqi security forces are not the same forces that we trained when we were there. Prime Minister Maliki replaced effective Sunni and Kurdish leaders with loyalists. So the Iraqi security forces are a shell of what they used to be. They're politicized. They're heavily infiltrated with Badr militia and Jaish al-Mehdi soldiers. The Hashd al-Shaabi, the popular mobilization units, are Iranian-backed Shia militia proxies. Right now, there are professional military officers in the Iraqi army that are not in positions of authority, and that's the biggest problem. While we can work with the Kurds, they're very limited in what they can do outside of areas that they care about. I would not, personally right now, we're recommending strategies. I would not send additional U.S. troops to Iraq unless we have a Sunni force to fall in on. We have to reconstitute a 30,000-man Sunni force from the former Sons of Iraq, the Awakening, and the Iraqi army. We don't need to train a new force. We just need to reconstitute the old one. They're there. I just came back from Iraq a couple days ago. I visited them in northern Iraq. There are 30,000 military-age males with military experience in Iraq that we need to partner with. And until we partner with them, we're not going to roll back ISIS. Only Sunnis can hold ISIS-controlled territory. Shia militias cannot, and unfortunately, Peshmerga cannot.
Michael Prejean just got back from Iraq. He's a former U.S. intelligence officer in Iraq who served as intelligence advisor to General David Petraeus. He's now an adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute. Hey, Michael, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Police in New Orleans continue to investigate the identities of shooters from a gang attack on a block party on Sunday. If there is an area code for hopelessness in America, it might be the New Orleans area code 504, with one of the highest murder rates in the country and a community with the deepest mistrust of police, according to the latest surveys. Baltimore tops the murder list with more than 300 in 2015. St. Louis, Milwaukee, and Washington, D.C. have also seen an uptick in murders this year. Those are the most visceral statistics, but a new report from the Brennan Center for Justice finds that the national crime rate has actually hardly changed since last year, and a number of cities have seen their murder rate shrink over the last 12 months. Reverend Jeffrey Brown says you can't change a culture of violence overnight, and whether it is the fear of terrorism in Paris or the fear of gang violence in Chicago, stopping it means getting individual, radicalized people with guns to put them down. Reverend Brown is the president of RECAP, Rebuilding Every Community Around Peace, and his initiative for a ceasefire this holiday season began on the streets of Boston, his hometown.
It started in conversations with youth on the streets, those involved with gangs and drugs. And what they simply said to me was that we need to learn how to not see each other and shoot on sight. Could there be periods of time in which we can call for ceasefires? And so the Season of Peace campaign came as a result of that. We go to all of the members and we say to them, you know, on behalf of the community, we are looking for you to stand down, in this case, between Thanksgiving and New Year's Day.
The discussion about when it's most important to stand down has often centered around right after when there's been an explosion of violence. This would be something that would just coincide with the holidays. Are they different?
Not necessarily. When an incident of violence occurs, you oftentimes have a lot of emotional feelings and reactions. But that's also an opportune time to go and have conversations with youth and with their families to talk about ways in which folks can stand down.
Why do clergy appear to have a degree of credibility above and beyond other voices in the community to deal with armed gangs in cities like Chicago and Boston?
Well, I think clergy are unique because they carry this moral voice. Churches are usually among the few positive institutions in the community. And when they are directed to the street level, then they can carry enormous credibility.
How does it work, though? I mean, why would police want to collaborate with ministers? Why would clergy want to be associated with discredited law enforcement in some of these cities that have had such problems?
Well, I think on the police side, because of those problems, it's very clear that there needs to be a concerted effort to repair police-community relations. On the community leader and faith leader side, it's very clear that no community can survive without some form of law enforcement. Either we have the formal kind with the police to work with, or we have the informal kind of a gang member posting up on the block trying to defend the block, and that's destroying our community.
Have you been at any of these meetings where all the voices and stakeholders that you're describing are at the table?
Absolutely. In the city of Boston, we've been practicing this for over 20 years. You have clergy people who are going out into the streets at night, working also with law enforcement, with probation officers, and city and community agencies, all working together, checking our egos at the door and realizing that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
We've talked with people around the country who are exploring different roles for police and different roles for people who aren't police. Do you think you can reduce the number of police if you increase the number of community members who are really engaged and involved?
If police departments begin to see themselves not as warriors, but as guardians within the community and supporters of a community's effort, then we'll have a much better place.
Reverend, how confident are you you'll get a ceasefire this holiday season?
I'm pretty confident in the cities that we've been working in that there's going to be some significant reductions in violence. My hope is that this will catch on, that folks will see that, you know, getting involved in this kind of work is not only important, but it also has results. And it will begin to change the character of the city and the era of violence in their city.
Reverend Jeffrey Brown is president of RECAP, that stands for Rebuilding Every Community Around Peace. Reverend, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Fear is bad business. Paris, the biggest tourist destination in the world, is discovering that this week, as holiday bookings are being canceled because of last week's attacks, and there is a global travel alert for U.S. travelers from the State Department. What do you think about that?
My name is Ralph Wilson. I'm calling from San Antonio, Texas, and I wouldn't use the term afraid, but the events in Paris have made me cautious. I was planning an extended vacation tour in Europe next summer, and I have altered my plans. I looked at it and thought, as many events as were going on and with the lockdowns, I will just wait a little bit and see if things don't improve. And meanwhile, in the United States, there's a whole lot of things to see anyway.
Stay home this holiday season, says Ralph. Others of you note that fear is not reality when you are making travel plans or formulating policies about migration, security, and defense.
It's Adam from San Leandro, California. Have I changed my behavior because of the recent events in Paris? Not at all. It's incredibly sad and deserves attention, but the dangers have been completely blown out of proportion. My family and I have been discussing this topic, and they feel like the world is falling apart. But I think our government should be logical enough not to change policy when events like this happen.
Well, what's the history in this kind of thing? Fear is bad business. Is it also bad politics? Corey Robin, the author of Fear, The History of a Political Idea, joins us. He's currently professor of political science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center right here in New York. So, Corey, is fear good politics in the sense that you can move the needle with it, but it's bad politics because it produces bad policy?
I think on the whole, it tends to be pretty bad politics. The problem with fear is that we're very selective about the things that we fear, as the callers that we just heard made clear. There are a lot of dangers, there are a lot of risks in the world, and we tend to focus on some rather than others. And the ones that we tend to focus on don't oftentimes necessarily track the real dangers that we actually are confronting.
Why is it working for someone like Donald Trump, for instance, who seems to be the Tom Brady of outrageous statements that cause people to be scared?
I do want surveillance. I will absolutely take database on the people coming in from Syria if we can't stop it, but we're going to.
Well, think about the different kinds of things that we could be afraid of. Climate change is one. Gun violence is another. Terrorism is a third. Of those three, only one of them, if you're going to try to fight it, involves relatively few costs to strong, dominant social lobbies, and that's, of course, terrorism. If you want to take on gun violence, you have to take on the NRA. The Republican Party doesn't want to do that. If you want to take on climate change, you have to take on the oil industry. So you pick a fear where the cost or the burden of dealing with it is borne by a relatively powerless social group, Muslims or Arab Americans. And it makes perfect sense politically for someone like Donald Trump.
In historical terms, the rhetoric is short-lived, but often the changes that are made are much, much longer duration, the Patriot Act being one after 9/11. Describe this quick rhetorical hit that's followed by a long, long period of consequences.
Yeah. Remember after 9/11, the entire media – our social institutions, politics, they were all jacked up and rhetorically, and everybody was talking. After a while, after a couple of years, that really began to subside. The policies and the infrastructure and the bureaucracy that were created in this place, you mentioned the Patriot Act, think about the Department of Homeland Security, all of those things still exist. I teach at Brooklyn College. There was just a story in one of the New York papers that surveillance of Muslim students on our campus is still continuing. Those policies that happen behind the scenes that we don't really get much attention focused on, those continue. So it's very easy for everybody to get caught up in the rhetoric. The real problem is the long-term consequences and impact.
When is an example of someone standing firm in the sort of hysteria and saying, you know, toe the line here or not following the prevailing sort of whims of fear?
That's a good question. I mean, I would say during the 1960s, you actually had people really begin to stand up to that kind of a thing. But that requires a broad social movement. But you did have figures, or actually, an even better example is the ACLU was actually created in the midst of the first Red Scare. A small group of people really banding together and trying to put a stop to things. A couple of dissenters, but it's the record is just not very strong on this score, unfortunately.
In many ways, that's sort of why we revere Lincoln so much, is that in the midst of extraordinary turmoil, he had the ability to take very unpopular positions and not allow the Union to be swept away.
Yeah, that's true, although we should – even Lincoln had some trouble.
Serious caveats, yeah.
With suspending the writ of habeas corpus. But that's actually a very good example that, for all the criticism that Lincoln got, that was a moment of tremendous, tremendous civil war when the nation's existence really was in peril. And if you compare it to other situations, what's most impressive about Lincoln is how much he did not succumb to the kind of hysteria that one would see, today when, however horrible terrorism is, it doesn't actually pose any kind of existential threat to the existence of the United States.
What's your greatest fear, Corey, about what might be put in place in the midst of, we haven't done immigration reform. It's still something that's, more than a decade overdue to be done, and now we're in the midst of this sort of fear discussion about Syrian migrants. What's your greatest fear of what might happen as a result of all this?
Mostly just an intensification of what already has been happening. In places like Brooklyn, where you have a large Arab and Muslim population, those communities have been under lockdown for quite a long time and slowly emerging. They were slowly emerging in the last couple of years. You have more and more Arab American and Muslim American activists speaking out, and we had the Black Lives Matter movement, which I think also helped bring attention to the kinds of issues that these communities are under threat. And my concern is that that brief glimmering that we saw in the last couple of years could be shut down again.
Corey Robin is the author of Fear, the History of a Political Idea. He's currently professor of political science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn something new every day with more than 20,000 lessons on art appreciation, accounting, auto repair, and more. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
Today, President Obama will underscore some of the deep contradictions that run through our history as a nation of immigrants, a national success story like no other, and a nation still troubled by unresolved issues of race and intolerance. Among the 17 Americans being awarded the nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom today, is a living relative of a man who stood up after Pearl Harbor to fight laws singling out Japanese Americans for curfews, detention, and surveillance. He was Minoru Yasui, who on March 28, 1942, just a few months after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, he walked into a Portland police station and demanded to be arrested for breaking the city's curfew for Japanese Americans.
What we were looking for, really, was an ideal case, a young ex-GI who'd been honorably discharged, married, because we wanted to create sympathy. But at that time, knowing the uncertainties, I could scarcely blame anyone for refusing to go ahead and deliberately violate the law. And it seemed to me that someone had to do it, and the ultimate choice became, since nobody else would do it, I did.
Minoru Yasui speaking with filmmaker Stephen Okazaki for a documentary that was produced in 1984. Yasui died in 1986, 2 years before President Reagan issued a formal apology for Japanese internment during World War II. Today, President Obama honors his legacy with a posthumous Medal of Freedom. Robin Yasui is Minoru Yasui's niece. She's in Washington to attend the Presidential Medal of Freedom ceremony on behalf of her uncle. Robin, welcome to The Takeaway, and how are you feeling?
Very excited. A long overdue honor, and we're very honored to be here in Washington on Uncle Min Yasui's behalf.
Tell me about your uncle's case and why he decided to challenge the laws that were in place during World War II. And in his particular case, he challenged a curfew, right?
That's correct. After the atrocious bombing of Pearl Harbor, Japanese immigrants and Japanese American U.S. citizens were suddenly considered to be potential enemy aliens and demonized as a threat to American security. And although it was a time of war hysteria and fear, understandably, our nation seemed to forget that most of us came to this country as immigrants, refugees, and asylees. And the public and the government let very irrational racial profiling and xenophobia run wild. Their answer to the bombing of Pearl Harbor was to label a subset of innocent immigrants and citizens of Japanese ancestry as a threat and lock them up in internment camps across the West. But the first major step towards this mass incarceration of Japanese American U.S. citizens was a curfew. So here's Min, this idealistic 25-year-old lawyer who fervently, passionately believed in the law and justice of the land, who saw the writing on the wall, and he felt that a curfew on a subset of citizens based solely on race was blatantly unconstitutional and that he needed to confront the government in the courts of law. So he violated that curfew in order to serve as a test case and challenge its constitutionality.
Now, his case went all the way to the Supreme Court.
It did, and he sat in solitary confinement in a 6-by-8-foot cell for 9 months waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on his case. And sadly, the Supreme Court sided with the government. Min lost his case, and after 9 months in solitary confinement, he went on to be interned in Minidoka camp.
How much of a betrayal was that for him?
Well, what's amazing is, in spite of all that, Min was just undaunted. He never stopped believing that the U.S. judicial system and the U.S. Constitution's protection of civil rights would win out in the end. And he knew that someday the courts would vindicate him and acknowledge that the curfew and internment of Japanese American citizens was an unjustified violation of constitutional rights, just driven by racial prejudice, wartime hysteria, and a failure of political leadership.
But is it that I mean, you know, President Obama says it's not who we are when we talk about singling people out by religion or ethnicity, sounding very much like your uncle. But yet, if you look at the historical record, it kind of is who we are. I mean, we make this mistake over and over again.
And this was Min's point. Min was very clear. This was never about him. It was never about just Japanese Americans. This was, and I want to quote him, this to me says everything that was going through this man's mind at age 25, at age 75. If we believe in America, if we believe in equal democracy, if we believe in law and justice, then each one of us, when we see or believe such errors are being made, have an obligation to make every effort to correct such mistakes.
Wow. It sounds like you carry that responsibility with you.
Absolutely. I think our family does. I think the Japanese-American community does. And it's something we hope to pass on to the next generation so they understand these hard-fought gains are something to still be vigilantly protected and cared about and spoken out about.
How do you feel about this current discussion about Syrian refugees and the vote in the House of Representatives?
Oh, my goodness. I think today the Japanese-American citizenry across the U.S. is listening in total disbelief as we hear echoes of this same irrational rhetoric launched against innocent Syrian refugees trying desperately to flee their war-torn country. And we listen to government officials and politicians fanning these flames of racial, ethnic, and religious profiling while they're trying to slam the door shut on people fleeing the same terrorists we're opposing. And thankfully, I hope that in 2015, there are calmer, rational voices of reason and compassion, both in the government and the public, who will come together to drown out those ugly voices and open America's doors again. And if Min Yasui were here today, he'd be leading the fight to push those doors open.
Is it the case that his conviction on curfew violation was never overturned?
You know, it's so interesting. What he really wanted was not only that personal vindication, but more than that, he wanted the U.S. government to not only apologize, but to acknowledge that this was an unconstitutional move. That is the only way to prevent it from happening again. And that, I can't say, has happened to the degree we had hoped it would. But this is certainly a major step in that direction, the recognition of his work and the value that this medal bestows upon that work.
What do you think Obama is going to say to you? What will you say to him?
Well, I think that the company in which Min is being honored and his legacy is being honored, there's so much diversity, there's so much richness, and we're just thrilled that in Obama's time, this award has come to him. I think that's incredibly appropriate as well.
Robin Yasui, have a wonderful day, and I look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you so very much.
Robin Yasui is the niece of Minoru Yasui, who will be accepting the Presidential Medal of Freedom on behalf of her uncle today at the White House. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.